both of them are somewhat, to some extent, there's a theocratic, theocratic dimension of their democracy. You know,
right.
Israel
right.
certainly being a Jewish state.
So they're both democracies
and,
with strong
and,
religious
and
parties.
Turkey being a democracy with a with an Islamist dimension, at least you can say,
right.
that's still able to operate, unlike, say, Iran, you know
oh,
what I mean?
Sure, right.
Able to,
I mean, Iran
to operate
the
with a
the
level of a theocratic dimension, yet
right.
not be, you know, an outlier politically from the rest of the world, not just the rest of the region. The other thing I think is, you know, Turkey certainly, I think it's smart of the Turkish government to do everything they can to work with Israel, because they certainly have, you know, you've got the Kurds there, you've got the Islamists, you've got the secular, so they certainly have a kind of a loose coalition, a ragged little coalition that any leader in Turkey has to hold together.
And he also achieved, you know, some support for Jordan, which is extremely important as well. Jordan
yes.
being one of the more stable countries over there, and now, you know, sort of buried with the relief problem from refugees fleeing, et cetera. And to be able to support Jordan and give them a strength is equally important. I think overall that his policies have been good. I don't agree with all the policy that we have towards Iran. I think we continue to create a verbal threat, which is a little bit over the top and makes it sort of, you know, like you're pushing somebody into a corner. But nevertheless, I trust Obama and the Obama administration to better in terms of dealing with Iran than I would certainly Bush or almost any other administration.
Yeah, I tell you, I'm glad you mentioned Iran. Coming up after this show, I'm doing a full two-hour special with four guests from all kinds of views on the Iran situation, and we're going to talk in detail about what's going on in Iran, both its dictatorship, its democracy, or lack thereof, and also about its nuclear program. And is it pursuing it? And if so, what can we do? So there's a full show coming on after this one. Let me, though, say one thing that I didn't like. President Obama spoke for about 50 minutes, and I thought a really beautiful, moving speech. I watched the entire thing, to a large Israeli audience. I would have, at the time, I said to my mother, because I'm here in Nashville, Tennessee, and I said, you know, is he going to give the same speech to the Palestinians? And I was surprised he did not. He only spoke to Abbas, their leader. I think just like he was smart to go around the Israeli leadership, I mean, he was definitely working with Netanyahu, but his speech was to the Israeli people. He should have given a speech to the Palestinian people in a room in Ramallah. I'm sure there was, you know, they could have gotten security, would have been tight, but he should have given a strong speech where he urged them, recognizing their historic rights, but at the same time urged them to reach across and to recognize a two-state solution. And I was surprised he didn't do that, so I will leave that as a criticism.
Well, I think there's two things here. Number one, I think recognizing the actual, in real terms, the power dynamics between the two, you know, the two entities, shall we say. You know, certainly I think he's recognizing that Israel has so much more economic, political, and military might that you really have to get them on board in order to make it happen, because you know if you there there is an element within the Palestinian political grew within the you know political environment that is that you're going to have setbacks, that even when you negotiate with the Palestinians and you're working your best and they are working their best, there's an element within that group that is going to try to screw it up because you know that's who they are. And I think he feels and I feel it's very important to get the Israelis on board to recognize, look, even when we work with them, there's an element that the harder we work and the closer we get to peace, there is a small element there that's going to say, we got to stop this. And I think it's probably true to some extent on both sides. But, you know, I think that the element within the Palestinians, you know, they don't have the power dynamics, but certainly that element can really throw a monkey wrench in things. So I, in my opinion, I think it was a matter of the power dynamics that he was looking at there. The other thing that I wanted to bring up, I think, that was important that he said was, and I felt it was important because there are a lot of people that don't know enough about the situation of one state solution, two state solution, et cetera. And that was, in an indirect way, and not a real direct way, basically what he said was this. Look, Israel's a democracy. If Israel wants to remain a democracy, there is going to have to be a Palestinian state. Israel cannot have a democracy where we say, we are democracy, Palestinians are Israelis too, except they can't vote or they don't have any political economic rights. I mean, any political rights. So if you really want to be a real democracy, you're going to have to give these people their own state, because if you keep them within your state, you're going to have to give them all the same voting rights and all the same rights as every other person in your society. You're not prepared to do that. So you got to decide what kind of democracy you're going to be. One that gives rights to every single person, which means the Palestinians are not going to be a part of that group, or one that says, yes, we're going to have a wonderful democracy, except this group right here, they can't vote or they don't have all the same rights. And I think that was important for people who really didn't understand the dynamics of the one and two state solutions.
And no matter what happens with that, I guess, to me,
one is that, you know, Netanyahu, as difficult as he can be, has been willing for, ever since he became prime minister, to sit down and have negotiations without preconditions with the Palestinian Authority. And Obama has endorsed that and basically has said to the Palestinians, look, sit down at the negotiating table, talk. And if things don't work out, you know, we'll be prodding both of you and we'll be talking to both of you. But the fact that you're staying away from the negotiation table because of preconditions means that nothing's going to get resolved. What I found in the room, and I think actually polls in Israel show, that a good two-thirds of the Israeli population wants a two-state solution. Very few Israelis want almost none of them want a one-state solution where Palestinians don't have rights. Obviously, the Arabs who are citizens of Israel have full rights there to vote and serve in parliament and so forth. But I think the answer is that the boundaries are, I mean, the everyone knows, and this is the point he also made in his speech, 90% of the land is agreed to. I mean, everyone agrees that the Arab areas of the West Bank are going to go to the Arabs, that the Jewish areas of the West Bank are going to go to the Jews. They can argue over tiny little details, but 90-plus percent, 95%, 96% is going to go to the Arabs. And there's a huge disagreement over Jerusalem, and there probably always will be. But the answer is that when you have a deal that's 90% done, I think Obama should have made strong encouragement, not just to Abbas, but to the Palestinian people, to put aside the 3 or 4 or 5% differences, get to negotiation, and start it up. And because if everyone's demanding everything be perfect before they even start to talk, they'll never talk.
And the other thing that's important here, I mean, people have criticized Obama for not going there sooner, considering the political turmoil in the Mideast. You know, it's hard to pick a good time to go if there is such a thing. And, you know, Egypt is still having its problem. Of course, Syria is a mess. And Iran is a question mark at the very least. And the Palestinians still haven't received a just approach to their situation. But the thing that he did provide is, in a way, and it can only be done face-to-face, frankly, and I admire him for doing that and his timing for doing that. You know, he introduced a little bit of stability into the Middle East by dealing with people directly and by dealing with primarily with the more stable governments, of course, Israel and Jordan being the primary examples of that. And if there's
one thing that's
absolutely needed in the Middle East, it's just even the illusion, the momentary, just a moment of stability of rational behavior. And I really think he carried that across throughout his trip.
I think he came over there and he really came across, and I this may be an overused term, particularly by me, but he came across as the adult in the room.
Yeah.
To where in some areas there are people who aren't necessarily adults in the room for any number of reasons. When you look at the issues in the Middle East, what they're related to? Fear, anger, and religion. And let me tell you, when you mix those three things together, you're in a world of deep and serious trouble. So I think he went in there and he tried to get away from the fear, anger, and religion. And I think here's the other thing too, Mark, and as far as whether he's talking to the Palestinians or going having that talk, believe me, they were all watching. And I think what was important was that he sent the message, and that was to all sides. And that was, look, And here's, and I've talked to people who are Palestinian and Israeli. There was a group that were Palestinian and Israeli, like teenagers, mm-hmm. who were traveling around the U.S. a while back. They were basically saying, look, you know, we just want to listen to music and dance and right. have fun and grow up and live our lives. I think what he recognizes is there are a lot of young, the younger people
right.
in Palestine and Israel, they want peace. They just want to live their lives. They're not all that concerned with, you know, the older people are more concerned with this other 10% beating themselves to death over it. That
right.
the younger people and most of the people, the Israeli people and the Palestinian people really want peace. And there are a couple of small elements that are stopping from getting that. And I think he was saying to the people, look, I recognize that you people want peace. Make your governments give you peace. Make your leaders give you peace.
And that's why I just kind of wish he'd given the same speech to a Palestinian audience that he gave to the Israeli audience that he did. I've long given my solution, which no one seems to have taken up on, but President Obama, since I know you listen to the Raucous Caucus, listen up to my solution. I think it's pretty good. My solution is that Israel be recognized in its 1967 boundaries, that Palestine be recognized on the 95-96% that everyone agrees in the West Bank should go to Palestine, and the areas that they disagree on, like Jerusalem and a few of the settlements, they just stay disputed. But then there is a Palestinian state. All the people that can vote there, 99% of the Palestinian population would be in that state, and they could still negotiate over that 10%. I'm not saying it'd be resolved one way or the other.
But at least
there would be a two-state solution. It would exist, and once people have their own state and they live in peace and they, you know, they can begin their economy, I have a feeling that the remaining disputes, as difficult as they are, would be easier to resolve than there being no Palestinian state. That's been my answer for a long time. No one's taken me up on it, but I guess that's because they just don't. Obama, Netanyahu, Abbas, they don't listen to me as much as they should. That's true.
There's no question of that. I just want to throw in one other quick thing, and I think it's an asset that Obama has to. I'm sure he is aware of it. I hope he remains aware of it. Who he is as a human being has enormous significance in dealing with the Middle East. We've never, ever had a president with the multicultural background that he has had. I'm just recently reading the new biography about Obama. It's somewhat critical, but also fascinating in the detail. And his exposure to different cultures and his ability to adjust and cope within those different cultures, from, you know, Indonesia to Hawaii to Chicago, is a phenomenal asset, and people recognize that of other cultures, and therefore that gives him an ace that no other president has ever had, and I hope he uses that card.
And of course he met with Miss Israel, the first Ethiopian-born Miss Israel, which I think is significant to Israel, to have
yes.
a black beauty queen.
Yes.
That's never happened in Israel before, and I thought that was a really kind of nice thing that happened while President Obama was president, to show that these are nations, the United States and Israel, that aren't based on race, but based on culture and you know, shared values. And I just thought that was a nice thing that happened to happen.
I'll tell you a reason it's important here in the United States, because within the African-American community, because of the dynamics, and if you think about the dynamics of what has happened in America, quite naturally you can recognize culturally why. The black community tends to identify with the Palestinians as opposed to the Israelis. The black community overall tends to see the Palestinians as being a poor, weak, oppressed people by the people with power and aggressive. Because of the power dynamics there in the black community, it makes sense. You see a model that appears to make sense to you. So the black people in America tend to identify with the Palestinians and purely see the Israelis as the aggressive, and the aggressors and Palestinians as a weak, oppressed group. I think one of the things that tends to do is tends to soften the black community and African-American community in America is tend to soften that feeling that, you know, okay, Israel is a, quote, you know, a white oppressor of a darker skinned people. It tends to mitigate that a little bit because, you know, a lot of that has to do with power dynamics and the visuals that the black community sees. So I think
I think Aina, who was just the new Israeli beauty queen, Miss Israel, she's going to compete in the Miss Universe pageant. I hope she does a tour of the United States, and
yes,
I hope she talks to black and Jewish audiences. I think she could be a real healer, frankly. It's a symbol. She's a symbol, but an important symbol to show that, you know, that Israel has black people who are black Jews who have a long distinguished history in Ethiopia. I mean, thousands of years old. They're as old as any other Jewish community outside of Israel, and in the Queen of Sheba and so forth. And to show another side to Israel that my guess is, Garland, most African Americans are not aware she even exists. Is that right?
Probably.
Just starting to a little bit. I think she should go towards the United States.
Again, it's just a green, but she's actually a very impressive woman. English is her third language, of course. But she's not just a very beautiful woman, but a very, I think, powerful spokesperson for Israel and for the diversity that exists within Israel. So
the other thing, you know, that I wish Americans would understand
more. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I know that Terry wants to talk about why Americans aren't getting it on the economy and how they possibly can get it. We'll be back with more of the Raucous Caucus right after this.
Listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Hello, my name is Jim Gray, and I am a judge of the Superior Court in California and a former federal prosecutor in Los Angeles. I would like to talk to you for a moment about marijuana. Did you know that since the federal government first banned marijuana in 1937, usage in this country has actually gone up by about 4,000%? Or did you know that in the Netherlands, where adults are allowed to possess small amounts of marijuana and buy it from government-regulated businesses, fewer adults and fewer teenagers smoke marijuana than here in our country? Or that an American is arrested on marijuana charges every 38 seconds? If you are wondering if any of this makes sense, you are not alone. To find out more, contact the Marijuana Policy Project at 1-877-JOIN-MPP or visit them on the web at mpp.org. Thank you and good luck to us all.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
The economic situation and I guess how Americans are confused by it. Tell me what you mean.
Well, it's a little bit beyond that, a little bit bigger than that. There's three basic points that Americans need to begin to understand, and some of our leaders need to begin talking realistically to them. One, if anything, we need more government, not less government, in this very, very, very complex time. Two, the imbalance in the wealth throughout the world, not just our country, but throughout the world, is an extreme danger to any kind of responsible governing. And three, all of this means, you know, that everybody's going to have to pay a little bit more taxes, and we've got to accept that reality. So our country has changed, the world has changed, and we're not really facing the realities of either. We blame the wrong people, we seek the wrong decisions. Let me just run a few facts here trying to make my point. Some of these you're familiar with, some of sure you're not quite aware of. But I know you, Mark and Garland, for the most part are. But between 1979 and 2007, the top 1% doubled their share of pre-tax income. 80% of us had our pre-tax income fall over. This is all before the recession. You know, that is truly significant, and it's kind of a worldwide pattern. It's not just the United States. And obviously, we haven't adjusted our taxes to reflect that. Examples of what this means and the examples of what the non-funding that is going on throughout our society of crucial events. A personal example, my neighbor right next door teaches high school physics. And we've got nice buildings and all that here in this area in Oregon. He has 37 students to a class. He only has 34 chairs, period. They have to count on sort of basic two or three kids being absent every single day.
That's
my
crazy.
Nephew's girlfriend tries to teach high school art to 40 students at a time within a 45-minute classroom session. It's absurd. Another example, Chicago is closing 54 neighborhood elementary schools because they haven't got the funding. The FAA is closing 149 airport control towers across the United States. And probably even more significant, the federal government, as we know, is the largest supporter of biomedical research. And just as we are on really kind of a scientific breaking point, the research for cancer solutions, Alzheimer's solutions, and influenza is going to be cut back. Global warming exists. The huge U.S. drought, the National Weather Service has pointed out, is going to continue this year. All of these things are changing, and we're not reacting to them. And one final thing, which is kind of really astounding because I know it's going to be the next political issue, is the rising price of gasoline. And the usual response is everybody will blame Obama and want us to go to our reserve without knowing that the U.S. output has actually risen by 14% of crude oil. Our output is going to overtake Saudi Arabia's output in 6 to 7 years,
wow,
even while our national demand has fallen.
Well,
the real reason prices are
one,
going
one
up
thing
in
at a time,
United
Terry,
States,
because the first thing
not,
I think you're pointing out
United
is the government
States
spending
is now a net exporter of crude oil for the first time in 60 years. We are exporting oil to Brazil, to China, et cetera, because you can make more money. And a final little just final little point on this, the whole reason for the Keystone Pipeline is to create a direct supply to the refineries owned by, you'll never guess, the Koch brothers.
Well, of course.
Yeah, but I mean, all this reality is here,
it.
And we're simply not dealing with it and not facing it. It's an economic problem, it's a perception of government problem, and it's a revenue problem. It's somehow or other, we've got to get the American public to realize this. And I don't know how to do that, guys.
Well, let's divide up your very complex issues into bite-sized pieces. Because
okay,
the first issue you make about spending, whether it's children needing more teachers and more classrooms in Oregon or Chicago, or any other needs, whether it's the FAA, I think when it comes to spending, Americans have a I like my spending, but I hate your spending problem.
Yep.
I was fascinated by an article I read in the Washington Post just about a week or two ago talking about tiny airports in rural Oklahoma where there's more birds on the runway than planes. A plane might come in once a week, and yet they have a full-time process there that basically subsidizing this tiny little airport because people don't want to drive an hour, and it's costing the tickets would be $1,000 each if they paid for them out of their own pocket, but we Americans subsidize it. Anyway, when the government in Rock Red, Oklahoma, decided to shut down this rural airport because of the sequester, they complained. They got very angry. They can't believe the government was going to do that. Just like in Yellowstone National Park, outside the park, when the government didn't, the federal government didn't clear the snow. And the answer was, well, Oklahoma, Wyoming, you believe in states' rights. Why don't you do it yourself? They're like, no, we're not going to do it ourselves. So part of it is just everyone wants the spending where it belongs, now where they live. Now, in my view, a kid's education is far more important than clearing some snow in Wyoming or having a rural airport with one plane a week in Oklahoma. But at the end of the day, everyone just wants the money where they live and not where other people live.
Yeah.
Well, Bill Maher had a great great segment the other night, and what he did, he went to this small town in New York that was devastated by Sandy, and it was also a very Tea Party, super red Tea Party community. So he went to them, and they actually recorded a number of people. And they said, okay, what do you think about the government? The government spends too much. We need cuts. The government should cut. Do you think the government should cut? Yes, absolutely. Are you supporting the Republicans' idea for cuts? Yes, I am. We need to cut. They said, okay, let's go down the list. Do you think we should cut the military? No. Do you think we should cut the money for hurricane response to Sandy? No. Do you think we should cut veterans' benefits? No. Social Security? No. Medicare? No. All the way down. And they said, what should we cut? Well, I don't know, but there's some ways we need to cut. And then in the last one girl they got to, she was standing outside in this Statue of Liberty uniform. And they said to her, okay, specifically, you're in charge. You are in favor of cuts. Yes, I am. I'm all for cuts. I'm 100% for government cuts. They said, name one thing that you think the government should cut. And if anybody wants to see this, just watch the rerun of the last Bill Maher show. She says, no, I can't think of anything. They said, just one thing they should cut. She says, I don't know. So Bill Maher's, after this, what he came up with, the people are idiots. And I think that's where Terry's saying that people don't get it. That's one way of putting it, that Americans are idiots. And I hate to sound arrogant and elitist, when I say that, because, to some extent, I'm probably an idiot right along with them in a lot of ways. But people buy into these political ideologies that say cut, 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 because somebody else is getting cut. But when you name something that can be cut, they say, they don't know. So what happens? They send these morons up to Congress who botch everything up. And this is what I always say. They're botching things up because they got morons at home that are saying, you better go cut. But I don't know of anything that really needs to be cut. And when they cut something, they don't like it. Then they're unhappy and say the government screwed up. Look how bad they're screwing us.
And you got to make a good point, and I think it has a lot to do with our leadership, and that's why I think I wish we'd get some more honest leadership, and probably the only place we're going to get it from is the Democrats, maybe a few Republicans. But the point, really, that you bring up, Garland, which is so solid, is Americans are now caught in so many ways in ideology, not facts, not reality. Ideology of any kind is simply a cop-out for thinking. And, for Republicans or citizens or radio talk show hosts or anybody to talk about needing a smaller government, and you can't have a smaller, you got to have a smaller government, and you got to have states' rights, without putting it in the context of our interconnectedness as a society, as a nation, industrially, economically, et cetera, is absolutely bull. It's nonsense. Unless you put it in the context of what our real world is, and our politicians, including even President Obama for the most part, aren't really talking about what this country and the world is facing today in terms of technology, money, jobs, et cetera, et cetera. It's not simple. It's complex. And somehow other Americans have got to understand that you got a simple answer, you have the wrong answer.
And it's not even true that they want a smaller government. I mean, when it comes to issues like states' rights to decide medical marijuana, they want a bigger government. They want to prohibit it. They want to use government to prohibit gambling. The Republicans want to use government to prevent a woman from having a right to choose what she does with her own body. They want to use government to prevent gay people from having the same rights that straight people have. So they use government all the time to distinguish and to violate people's civil rights. They're fine with that. They want government to fund religion, right? That's not less government. That's more government. So the issues need to get away from the rhetoric, smaller government, bigger government, and talk about what the things actually do. And that's, I think, the point Garland's making, or Bill Maher was making, that when you talk about what government actually does, most people say, well, I like the stuff it does for me. Now, I may not like the stuff it does for other people. Some people will say, well, that's the welfare people. Or I would say personally the agricultural subsidies. I'm not a farmer. I'm not big on agricultural subsidies. I think most go to agribusinesses. I would cut all those, and I certainly would cut the subsidies to oil companies and people like the Koch brothers. But at the end of the day, when people think they can get everything they want and there's never going to be any compromise, everyone's got to hurt if you're going to cut or you have to raise taxes, which causes pain for everyone. And the answer is just no free lunch. And I don't know how you get that across, because Americans reward politicians who say there is a free lunch. The most famous of those is Ronald Reagan. He was the first guy to come to office and say, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to lower taxes, I'm going to increase military spending, and I'm going to balance the budget. And the answer is that just doesn't add up. But he was a very popular president, because you tell people they're going to have a chicken in every pot, 40 acres in a mule. You can think of a million examples of politicians promising things, and everybody wants everything, and nobody wants hard choices.
And what we're talking about here, and let me be clear about, I'm talking mainly about the right wing of politics in America, to some extent to the left, but mainly about the right wing and the alleged center, which I don't believe really exists. And that is this. There are inherent contradictions within the right-wing ideology and within the overall ideology of the U.S., but I believe more so within the right-wing ideology. There are inherent contradictions. Now, I believe that what's happening now is that those contradictions are slamming up against each other. The contradictions between the super wealthy corporate top 1% that are getting everything, who will basically tell people, you know, look, go along with anything I say, and I'll support your authoritarian social, bully social beliefs. And I think the other issue, of course, being the libertarians, which aren't really the same as conservatives. Libertarians are very, very different than traditional conservatives.
That's true.
And I think on the right, one of the things we're seeing right now, and that right clash is hurting us all, the differences and the chasms and contradictions between the social right-wingers, the authoritarian social right-wingers, the top 1% corporately wealthy elitist, and of course the darn near anarchist libertarians. And we're in a heck of a mess as those three clash and the rest of us have to fall to pieces. And meanwhile, last but not least, even at that, the top 1% are even allowing that to crash together. And they're still walking away. No matter what happens, the top 1% walk away with the entire bank in their pockets.
And the other thing that I'm still looking for an answer for, guys, I know that the three of us, I think, understand the situation pretty well. We preach about it. We try to educate about it. We do our research. We understand it. What is it going to take, or how are we going to get the American public to understand that there aren't these simple, simplistic answers? How are we going to achieve that? Who are we going to get to be our spokesman? Where is the leader that's going to teach us, the American public, that, or even have the guts to stand up and say it?
I have a suggestion.
Goody.
My answer is a video game. We all like video games, right? I mean, this is sort of pretty popular. I suggest we prepare. It wouldn't be that hard to do, actually. You get like an email scenario, and you send it virally to people's mailboxes, and it's called Cut Your Budget, or Balance the Budget, it should be called. And then what you can do is they actually show you the U.S. budget. So much goes to Social Security, so much goes to Medicare, so much goes to defense. And you could click on it and find out specifically where the defense money goes, where Social Security money goes, how little goes to welfare, how little goes to foreign aid, so people can't say, oh yeah, we'll cut all that, it's 1% of the budget. And also you could increase taxes and basically tell people as a game, go ahead, try to balance the budget. And he'll see that it involves difficult choices, and there ain't no easy answer. There just isn't.
But how are you going to have a video game? I mean, that's a good idea, Mark, but how are you going to have a video game where you don't get to shoot 58 people and blow up 40 million things?
Well, if you balance the budget, you get to blow up a building. I don't know.
Okay.
I haven't worked on it yet. I just thought of it.
That's good. That may work.
As long as there's violence involved, Americans will certainly be in favor of violence in some way, shape, or form. I mean,
maybe you shoot at Social Security. I don't know. Okay, I have to. It's back to the drawing board, but I'll think about it. I'll get my technicians to work on it right away. That video game. Anyway, let's just take another quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to get back to Garland's talk about why our government is broken and what we can do to fix it. This is Mark Levine, Garland Nixon, and Terry DeKester of the Raucous Caucus. We'll be right back right after this.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Does your child have difficulty controlling their anger or a history of academic failure in school? Options Public Charter School offers a therapeutic learning environment with small classroom sizes and on-site counseling services to help students succeed. Options PCS is now enrolling grades 5 through 11 for the upcoming school year. For more information, call Options PCS today at 202-547-1028. Options Public Charter School, exceptional education for exceptional students.
Hello, world. It's your boy, Richard. Every night when I get home, I find myself quite thirsty. Thirsty for an adult beverage. And that is why I prefer a tall glass of organic wine from the Organic Wine Company. Founded in 1972, the Organic Wine Company is the nation's oldest importer of organically produced wines. They have a tremendous selection, red, white, sparkling, and dessert wines, and it's oh so tasty. It's easy and inexpensive to ship right to your door. For a limited time, you can get an even bigger savings by visiting ecowines.com and using the coupon code FowlerShow. Join the movement, of good-tasting, earth-friendly wine drinkers, led by the fine folks at the Organic Wine Company. You can find them online at ecowines.com or give them a call, 1-888-ECOWINES.com. And don't forget to use that coupon code, FowlerShow, for your extra special discount.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Welcome back to the Raucous Caucus. This is Mark Levine with Terry DeKester and Garland Nixon. And Garland, it's your turn. Apparently, you think our government's broken? Why do you think our government's broken? Just because they can't achieve anything?
Yeah, and I think, you know, our government's broken because of something that I said earlier, and that is because of the collapse of the Republican Party and the takeover by the far right. And I think here's what it boils down to. Over the past 30 years or so, what we've seen is the mainstreaming of very, very radical extreme policies. What the Republicans learned, and I would argue that it started with, you know, the conversion of racism. There was a time with the KKK, you know, they ran around and they waved their flags, and they learned that we can't do that anymore. So they put a suit and tie on it, and they started using, you know, code words and saying things that made it sound political, as opposed to, you know, as opposed to discriminatory and race related and class related. And I think one of the things the far right learned was that if you take extreme policies and put a suit and tie on them and make them sound like Paul Ryan does, you take extreme, vicious, heartless policies and make them sound as though that they are simply political realities that we must face and use lots of code words, that there are a lot of Americans who are politically ignorant enough and politically uninformed enough to buy into them. So I think at the root of it is the mainstreaming and normalization of extremely radical social, political, and economic policies. And that what has happened eventually was that we got to the point where the Republican Party collapsed under its own weight. It is now just a group of warring factions that is being headed. You know how when you get a group of warring factions, the one with the most guns and the wins. So the far right has taken control, and now they are trying. They believe that they can take extremely radical social and economic policies and mainstream them. So I think that's what we're looking at.
Gentlemen, I think it's an even bigger reason. And let me interject this, because I think it's a bigger reason that even precedes that, Garland. Our government at first, as most of us know, not most of our listeners know, I'm sure, you know, was really founded by and for the elitist. It wasn't followed sure. by and for. It was, you know, founded mm-hmm. by and for the
white
wealthy.
Man with
it wasn't
property.
Founded by and for the public, the average person, be they black or white, indentured servant or slave. That's not why it was founded.
It's about money,
that,
right?
And then the government, as it evolved, eventually, you know, sort of got a little more democratic, but patronage grew right with it, and then extreme patronage grew with it, to the point where finally the government, you know, created some laws that, you know, kind of outlawed patronage, et cetera, et cetera. Now we have evolved again where the patronage is via the lobbyist. And this has built and built and built that anybody that goes into government is almost guaranteed, at least at the congressional level and the congressional aid level, guaranteed of bigger jobs within the very industries that they're supposed to be legislating, be it in foundations, be it directly into the industry, be it into lobbyists. There is this cycle of patronage, bribes, however you want to define it, created by this incredible, uncontrolled, unregulated patronage and and lobbyist establishment that we have that has eroded the government's effectiveness, because the purpose for the individual in government now is simply to progress in their own career and their own power, and this is a system that does it. Therefore, extremism comes into it because the lobbyists, more than any other factor, have divided the country into it's their way or the highway. There's only one point of view promoted by every single lobbying group. And that's really, to me, the root cause of what's happened.
Both of you know I used to work as an attorney in Congress. Most of my listeners know that as well. And I got to tell you, I saw that revolving door up close. I mean,
yeah.
I saw people, mostly Republicans, but not too shabby number of Democrats who would work and be on one committee and would oversee, for example, I was on the Homeland Security Committee. So people would sit on the Homeland Security Committee, and then they would go out and be a lobbyist for the defense military industry.
Yep.
And, you know, if I had just cashed in on that deal, I actually was offered several lobbying jobs. I refused them all because I wanted to be with you, Garland, and with you, Terry, making no money and trying to persuade people on the radio of goodness, light, and truth. But it
created a much sweeter person.
Yes, yes. But I could have really raked it in if I'd merely sold my soul. And apparently, you have to, like, play a banjo or something to get it back, a fiddle. I forget the rules of the song. But the point is that I was offered that as well, and I turned it down, but I saw it up close. And this revolving door between government and industry and lobbyists, and suddenly it spins so fast, and you don't know who's on whose side before, but the moneyed interests win. And
yep.
And I think you're right, Terry, that we're going back to the old days when white men with property were the only ones with power. Now it's not only white and not only men, but it's definitely the people with property. It's definitely the wealthy, and they are getting more and more power. You mentioned the Koch brothers early on in the last segment about how they're controlling our energy policy, and that's all part of the revolving door of government and lobbyists. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right, and the other part is this. We started off with a country that was, basically a feudal society.
Right.
And along came the robber barons, and it turned into a feudal society that was based on a capitalist feudal society where, instead of lords and earls, we had the and dukes, we had the robber barons and their offspring, the 1/10 of 1/10 of 1% and their privileged offspring.
Right. The Carnegies, the Rockefellers.
But along came the union.
We know the names. Andrew
and
Carnegie.
For the first time in probably the history of mankind, this gigantic in a huge powerful society, a gigantic middle class started to appear. However, again, over the past 30 to 40 years, as the unions have declined, so has the middle class. And I argue, I would make the point that the very, very wealthy recognize that, and their number one goal, the top 1/10 of 1% decided, our number one goal is to do away with the unions. They are our problem. And as the unions are done away with, the middle class goes with them. And it can't be, it can't possibly be an accident that it just, a coincidence. Coincidentally, as the unions grew, the middle class grew. And coincidentally, as the unions started to disappear, the middle class disappeared. Well, that's what we're up against now. The middle class, the unions are disappearing. And for all of the other things that we're trying to do and all of the economic and political and social discussions that we are, that we are having, if we cannot rebuild the unions, the workers have no rights, the super wealthy corporate, international corporate magnates get all the power, shrink the government, take what little power the government had over, and we fall back into a feudal society, which is, we're there.
And we got to realize, too, that there's no executive or no powerful politician that really has gone to work with the idea of, by golly, let's create a really strong middle class. That would be more just and more economically viable. There's nobody that has ever proposed that honestly as their reason for taking power or serving or whatever they want to call it.
Actually, Terry,
the middle class
I think
was
Joe
created
Biden
for one reason, and that was
I think that's
consume.
Kind of his big issue in his time in Congress and as vice president. I probably hear the words middle class from Joe Biden more than any other politician on the national scene.
You're right. That's one. Good.
Yeah, I just want to give an example. I don't think it's no one. I agree that the voices aren't loud, but that's one thing that I've always been very, very proud of our vice president about, and he's always about strengthening the middle class.
Yeah,
and
one of the things that's always pointed out, is Henry Ford supposedly trying to give his workers enough
right.
money so they could buy a Ford.
Exactly.
Well, that was nice, and that was cute, but his real goal, of course, was his own personal wealth.
Right, but that's the irony of all of this, is that the extremely rich would make even more money if they had enough of a strong middle class to buy their products. So,
and that's before they discovered managed capitalism, and now they don't need the middle class to create their money.
Well, that's true. To some extent, with technology and so forth, and automated robots, and frankly, cheap labor in China and India and Mexico, the American worker is becoming expendable. But Garland, yep. This is your point. How do we get out of this morass? How do we
throw this in for all the glorification of Henry Ford. I don't think there could have been a more anti-Semitic human being outside of Nazi Germany on the face of this planet than Henry Ford, number one.
That's true.
And number two, let's not forget that here's also the guy who, when his employees marched across Detroit and marched to the Ford plant to complain about their wages and benefits, he hired thugs who beat and murdered a number of them. For standing up for simply trying to get things a little better than they were. Henry Ford, I mean, he was just another robber baron, and in fact maybe one of the worst of them. I think the only thing we can do is we can try to continually to do what we're doing to try to educate people, because as we discussed earlier, a lot of this is based on the ignorance of the Americans. As long as people are walking around saying, I'm going to vote for this guy because he says that he's going to go and he's going to cut. And when you say to them, you're going to vote for this guy because he's going to go cut? Yes, I am. We want cuts. What do you want cut? I don't know. Well, how about I'm going to name every program in the government. Which one do you want cut? None of them. So as long as we have voters who are that uninformed and ignorant, this is the very natural result of what you get. You know, if you take Garland Nixon, who does not know how to fly a 747, and put me behind the seat of a plane at 30,000 feet, I'm going to come crashing down into the ocean. If I'm lucky, I'll hit the ocean and not a city. So we put people like that behind the wheel of politicians, and they're voting in some of these Ted Cruz's and these people. Can we really expect anything else?
We've got to keep Garland out of airplanes. There's no question about it.
I would keep Garland away from
that. That's the first thing we have to do.
I'm going to stay in the passenger section. That's where I'll be.
Okay. I think one of the things that we have to do, we have the institutions to solve the problem. I mean, what government should do if it's responsible is you have your elected representatives, that's fine, but then you have separate agencies that do the work, do the research, discover what the issues are, present them supposedly to the congressman, and that they can vote therefore intelligently based on what the independent agencies provide them with. As opposed to that, now we've got this system again where they go to strictly the lobbyists, and the lobbyists are never going to present, I don't care if it's the ACLU or the Koch brothers, you're never going to get a totally objective, pluralistic point of view. You're going to get one side of the view.
The poor ACLU has no money to fund a decent lobby. We talked to them, but I don't know many other people in Congress who did.
Well, what difference are the lobbyists going to make?
Lobbying,
when you got a bunch of Tea Party members in the House. You know, I mean, when you've got
people who
the most absurd things in the world. When you've got people, you know, that either talk about legitimate rape or support people who talk about these kinds of absurd things. Of all the lobbyists in the world, I mean, part of it is the lobbyists, but look at the people that we've got in the House right now. Look at these clowns, that we've got. And of course, Ted Cruz being from Terry's particularly favorite state.
Yes, Texas. Well, you got to realize, though, too, that even with these nutcases that are in Congress, they are a result of the division created by the lobbying effort, the fracturing of our government and our government's systems of getting information. They are a direct and natural result of that.
Well, yeah. In terms of broken government, I would just say that it's not just an issue of the Republican Party and all the awfulness that it has. It's also a matter, I think, of progressives pushing the Democrats, pushing President Obama, pushing the system. You know, the Republicans only have power in the House because of gerrymandering, because they redraw the district lines. Remember, more Americans voted for Democrats in the House of Representatives than Republicans. But they have power because they draw the district lines. Who draws the district lines? State legislatures. And how many times have you heard progressives say, we need to get out there and support Democratic candidates to the state assembly? I don't think enough. And to me, that we need to work at all levels of government and not just blame the National Republican Party, because we have to, because they exist because of other things in our system. And we got to remember, as part of We Act Radio, that we have to act on all kinds of fronts. It's easy to sit back and just, you know, condemn the dysfunctional Republican Party, but we have to act at our state and local levels as well.
Right,
no,
and the Republican Party is broken, and even now, they're going back to, what do we need to do? We need to change the way we talk. The Republican Party will never figure out that you can't talk your way out of something that you behaved yourself into. They'll never get that.
And with that, I think we're going to keep going.
We're running out of time, Mark, so it certainly has been a pleasure with you and Terry, as it is every week.
It has been, and we're, of course, coming back next week. You can hear the Raucous Caucus every Sunday on We Act Radio, AM 1480. I play it live, and I archive the show on my website at MarkLevineTalk.com. You can follow me on Twitter at MarkLevineTalk. Terry, where can they find you?
Dr. Democracy, Dr. Democracy, AOL.
Okay, and Garland, you?
GarlandN at gmail.com.
That's terrific. All right, so
thanks,
come back and join us again, the Raucous Caucus, next week, Sunday, AM 1480. Coming up next, a very important program on the situation in Iran with some experts. You're going to hear details you've never heard anywhere else. Coming up on the Inside Scoop right after this.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Hello, this is Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and I want to tell you about my new favorite discovery, Yosemite National Park. I recently went there with my husband and children, and we walked the trails to see the breathtaking waterfalls, admired the grand meadows and giant sequoias. But the future of our national parks is uncertain. Many challenges face our parks today, from polluted air and water to development threats outside their borders and inadequate funding to protect our national heritage. That's why the National Parks Conservation Association recently completed a decade-long assessment of the challenges facing our national parks, along with proposed actions that will ensure our children and grandchildren will be able to enjoy the parks as we have.